Hello and welcome to the roundtable with me, Sunny Martin.
And Yajgran Akot.
And today we shall be discussing about the 9th anniversary of South Sudan's independence and the status of nation building.
South Sudan seceded from Sudan on 9th July 2011 and after 21 years of civil war to become the world's youngest nation.
And in January 2011, South Sudan from all walks of life across the globe voted in a referendum that confirmed their aspiration amidst jubilation and expectations.
But barely 2 years into independence, the hopes and expectations of these people were shattered when the country descended into civil war on 15th December 2013, under heavy weight of challenges of nation and state buildings.
9 years down the line, hopes and expectations of the people are still very high amidst the high challenges of the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement that was signed in 2018.
Dear listeners, joining us today on the panel to discuss the very topic that that has just been introduced is Dr. Santina Ayuel Longar, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Juba.
And we also have in the studio here Dr. Benjamin Machar, a former lecturer at the University of Juba, or the University of Townsend University in the U.S., and also a political analyst in South Sudan here.
With us is a civil and political rights activist in the name of Lona Merkaji, and a member of civil society organization, as well as a member of NCSC.
Yes, and also we have here Dr. James Okuk, who is from the Center for Strategic and Policy Studies, and our lines will be open to you later on, where you can call us on 0912062079 or 0912062950. Those are all our lines. You can call us this Saturday and talk to us here on our topic, the 9th anniversary of South Sudan's independence and the status of nation building. Right away, let's begin by introducing our guest right here, Mary Kaja. Good morning and welcome to Radio Mirror.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Okuk, welcome.
Thank you.
And also we have, the famous name. He has been here many, many times, Dr. Santino Ayuel Longar. You are most welcome to Radio Mirror.
Thank you, Sunny Martin and James Yaj, for the opportunity.
Dr. Ben Machar, a political scientist, welcome.
Thank you so very much for having me this morning.
Okay, right away, first of all, I should say happy 9th independence anniversary to all of us in the studio here.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know
Thank
that you. It is worth
it's,
it.
It's important to commemorate the independence.
Okay. And James O'Cook, is it worth saying happy independence, given what has happened?
Of course. It has to be a happy independence because we are remembering the day we jubilated on the 9th of July 2011 with a lot of expectations and promises for events. But as we are here today, we are enjoying something like a hell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes us bitter, but it will not prevent us to say happy memory of that day, although the expectation have not been met. Yes.
All right.
Dr. Okuk, I remember very much on the declaration of South Sudan independence. I was in WOW and I really witnessed what the South Sudanese were experiencing. A lot of jubilation, people were so excited, expectations were very, very, very high. But that tell us that told us at that time that we were we got what we expected. And now, this is the situation. What do you make of this after 9 years? What have you seen and what have you not seen, comparing it with your expectation?
I will put it into two categories. I just used the SWOT analysis.
Yes.
And I put it into the context of what we call the pestle benchmarking.
Yeah.
If we look at the SWOT analysis of our situation, the strengths of our people has been the resilience, despite what happened, you can see that up to today they are resilient. And they have been resilient during the struggle. That's why they got that happy day of 9 July. The second one is the weakness. Our weakness has been violence. We are not patient. Any small thing, we just rush to fight. And our reasoning is not used immediately. We use the reasoning maybe later, but immediately. And that has been our weakness. And that weakness has continued from that day of independence up to now, the violence. The opportunities that we have is the resources, both natural and human resources that South Sudan has been blessed with. We have oil, we have non-oil revenues, we have a lot of intellectuals who have really studied very highly, including some of us here who are PhD holders from top universities in the region and in the world. And that is a human resource that South Sudan is blessed with. It is an opportunity.
Okay.
But an opportunity which has never been utilized well. Because if you look at what's happening in the public sector, it is the people who are not qualified who are in the offices. And the real qualified people are running under trees and somewhere or in diaspora.
Okay.
That's it. The last one, which is the threat. The threat has been the insecurity. And that insecurity is the result of our attitude of violence. And this insecurity has been exacerbated by corruption, tribalism, and all this. So this is what analysis gives you the real picture of where we are today from where we started. If you combine it with the pistol benchmarks, but I don't know whether I have time for that.
We shall come back to it later on, Dr.
Okay.
Okuk.
Okay, let's find out more. I want to get your insight from Dr. Santino and also Dr. Benjamin plus Lona Merikaje. After South Sudan got its independence on the 9th of July 2011, what are some of the alternative approaches that our leaders of this country should have instigated to cause the reforms that could have turned the violent society into one at peace with itself and the neighbors? Let's begin with Dr. Santino.
Thank you, Sandy Martin. the process of state and nation building is difficult. It's historically that has been the case. Many countries that we see as successful today, whether in Europe or in Asia or in Africa, have undergone a lot of challenges. So what South Sudan is going through today is a rite of passage in terms of state and nation building. Under Montevideo Convention of 1933, a statehood is defined in terms of a definitive territory, a sovereign government, the ability of a society to enter into an international contract, and a definitive population. So under those, you can see that if you fit those elements into what South Sudan is, then we can say South Sudan has attained statehood. If you go to Europe or go to any other country carrying the passport of South Sudan, nobody will ask you, where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
People will automatically know that you are a South Sudanese. And that is an achievement by itself. The many generations that came before us sacrificed in order for us to have this country. So we should be proud of it. But that what I just said, those are the legal criteria for determining this, what a state is. But there is also another dimension of statehood, which is called empirical sovereignty, empirical statehood. A state is supposed to deliver basic necessities to its people: security, food, healthcare,
education, and many more.
That is the dimension that South Sudan has been so much challenged. And so even if we are undergoing a difficult moment now, I hope down the line that these are punches that normally many countries have experienced. So down the line, I think we will be able to.
So that is the question we are asking: what should have been done by the leaders right from July 9th, 2011?
You know the kind of leaders we have are the ones, the very ones that we had during the liberation struggle.
Yeah.
And you know how much they went through. They were fighting each other. They were friends at some point, and then they split. And then because of those experiences, you know, it's difficult for them to work with one another. There's power struggle. There is, like what Dr. Okok just said, elements of tribalism, of corruption, and the ability to manage a state, especially when you have just come from the bush, is challenging. And so the challenges that they are facing are challenges of relating to their ability to build a state. They have not been able to recruit competent people to support them mm-hmm. in running the country. So what they should have done from the get-go was to make sure that the generations that, like what they call the Jeshamer and many other people who have invested in education, those are the people that they should have used to help them run the country. But I think they look the other way around. And so the potholes that they found along the way, they were not able to come out of it. So I think from the get-go, the idea of what South Sudan should be, or what South Sudan is, and what South Sudan should be, should have been the number one. So they did not have an idea, what South Sudan shall we have down the line, 10 years, what kind of South Sudan shall we have?
Okay.
It was all about interest.
All right.
And so I think...
Let's find out more from Dr. Benjamin and Lorna. First, Benjamin.
Thank you so much. The question is in the right forms. First and foremost, I'm a political scientist by training, and I will speak as a political scientist.
Yeah.
Second, the period in which we gain our independence until this time in South Sudan political history is the foundation of the state. And this state is always very, very, very difficult, very frustrating, as some of my colleagues or my discussions have and will continue to allude to. So foundations or founding of the Republic is not an easy stage. It is the most difficult one. Second, it is the stage in which the state is contested by those who had fought to liberate or to take over from other social group within the country. Take, for example, in the United States, during their struggles to liberate themselves from Great Britain in 1776, the society or the social forces were divided into several groups. One of them was preparing the independence from the crown. The other one was actually preparing to stay with the crown. And the group that actually started the war won. And the group that actually sided with the crown had to leave and go to Canada.
And to contextualize it to the South Sudan context, how do you relate that?
I'm bringing it back. So in our case here, the state has been founded, but at the same time, the state is still contested. So the war that is going on in South Sudan in particular is a continuation of where one is stood during the North-South War.
Yeah.
And this is a contest of the states. And so the victim here is the question of security, stability, rule of law, and others. Those are the first that should have been addressed before we have actually gone into other things. Second, when you found a state, we should always be thinking about what type of society that state is in it, because state is not bigger than the society. Society is the bigger entity, and state and governments are organization within the society. As reflected very well by some of the discussion here, our attitudes, especially one ilotic attitude in this society, we do not have that much patience. And that is what is actually informing the state that we are seeing in South Sudan. That is very corrupt, that is very nepotistic, and that is very individualistic, interest-oriented, rather than inculcating some collective interests that should be used as a baseline to come down to the question of nation building, because we have not yet actually founded the state and constructed the state. State has to be founded, and it has been founded legally, but it has to be constructed politically to make sure that security, stability, and rule of law are realized in South Sudan.
Okay. Thank you. Lorna?
Thank you very much. I think this is a very interesting debate, and I'm glad to share this conversation with political scientists.
Legal scholars, and so forth.
Yes. I think this is really, really important, because you realize that what my colleagues have said is actually true. Legally, we have a state, but then the question is, do we have a nation? But I would want to take us back to all the facts that colleagues have put on the table, that this is a process. My question is, what do we learn from processes? How many countries have gone through this? What lessons do South Sudan learn? For me, really, that is where I keep asking the question. And going back to your question of what could have been an alternative way, or what would have our leaders done, I think where we missed the point is that when we got independence, or right when CPO was signed, we got excited and lost vision. To be honest, I would say that South Sudan lost vision, and that is where we got it wrong. Because during the liberation movement, there were values that held the liberation together. And all these facts that my colleagues are sharing were known to so many people, that state building or establishing a state is not an easy process. These are the challenges that await us. But I think when we signed CPA, our leaders lost focus of that. They thought they have reached the final destination, and excitement set in. And I must say that excitement set in because we were received, South Sudan was received during the interim period from 2005 to 2011 with much resources that have never been seen in the bush. So that brought confusion. For me, as a citizen of this country, the point we missed is that when we got the dollars, one, we forgot the values that we fought for, which were justice, liberty, and prosperity for all. That was put aside. It turned to justice, liberty, and prosperity for myself. And on that note, then we lost the focus of planning, the focus of strategizing, and the interest to see a country move from point A to B. I think what we need to do at this moment, where we have lost it all, and this is the 9th anniversary of our independence, we need to go back to the drawing board. We need to understand what kind of state do we want. We need to define that, and we need to be, to have clear standards. One of the colleagues have said that the qualified South Sudanese are out and the unqualified ones are in the office. Mainly it's because we have no standards. You know, in this country, I'm tempted to think that it's usually thought that as long as I know you, you can do anything. Mm-hmm. So if I know you,
Is that helpful to a country like South Sudan that's supposed to deliver, like Dr. Santino said?
It's actually one of the ingredients that has brought us this far. So if today South Sudan is a success, then that is helpful. But if South Sudan is not a success, I think definitely that is not helpful. And to me, South Sudan today is not the country we dream of. When I remember the euphoria and the excitement and the investment we did for independence of this country, I was sharing with one of colleagues that, you know, last year independence was a somber mood. It gave me a somber mood because the state at which the country is was very sad. It was contrary to what we struggled for, and that gave me it made me to reflect and ask myself so many questions. But the question is, those at the driving seat, are they asking the same questions? Are they happy with what they have done? That, to me, is the question as an activist.
Thank you very much, Leona. We shall come back. Dr. Okuk, having learned that our leaders went wrong somewhere else, and all South Sudanese from the very beginning, we have seen where we have gone wrong. Now, we have experienced the consequences of having gone wrong, and we have war. We had war from 2013 to 2018. Hopefully, by this we still have some problem here and there, but it is going to stabilize, I believe. Now, having these experiences, having learned consequences of civil war, now we have peace with us in the country. What do you think we have learned that is instrumental in continuing nation building in South Sudan?
We have not learned anything. That is the
we have seen people have died. People have died.
That is the sad reality. People is,
yeah.
And why I'm saying we have not learned anything, because we keep recycling the same faces and the same personalities who have created the problem. We keep recycling them and giving them the responsibilities. That's one thing. So it tells you you are not learning if you keep recycling the same person and you expect different result from that person.
But who should replace the person you talk about?
I said before, South Sudan does not lack human resources. It's only that they are not utilized so that the right people are put in the right places. This is not happening. And we keep...
As a political scientist, Dr. Okuk, you know that power is not given. Power, I mean, political power is not given. You don't expect somebody to hand it over to you. So you have to institute something so that you share in that power.
No, everything about the country is not political power alone. Political power is just one aspect of it, and it is more of aspect of leadership of it. But you have other aspects. You have bureaucratic aspect, you have institutional aspect, you have legal aspect, you have professional aspect, all this. These are hands. You don't just grab it. For you to be a professional, you need to have developed skills. If you do not have those skills, there is no way you can just become a professional in one day by being put in an office which does not match your capabilities. It doesn't happen. And this is what has brought us to this. We think that the country is politics alone. Countries cannot be built on dirty politics particularly. And this is where we think that every politician has the right to direct anything. He has the right to be a lawyer. He has the right to be a lecturer in the university. He has the right to be a farmer. And all this is the mistake that our politicians have gotten themselves to. And as Dr. Santino said it before, this is what they inherited from the SPLM struggle. Because if you are a commander in the SPLA, you are everything, and you don't respect the rest of the aspect of the country. This is what is letting us to this moment. But we have not learned lesson. This is the bottom line of it.
What is the way forward?
Had we learned lessons, I think we would have become better now. We would have seen different faces in the government, mm-hmm. and in the government institution. We would have built a strong institution, okay, which respect the laws, which have plans, okay, which respect those plans, and which respect professionalism, which respect competence, all this. We would have built that bureaucracy, and that bureaucracy would have helped the political side of our government. It is not happening. Even the private sector that is supposed to complement the public sector is full of crooks and con men. Most of them are calling themselves businessmen, but they run to the Ministry of Finance, take the money from there, and pretend that it is their money that they are investing in the country. You can't build a country like that. You know, if you are a businessman, you should have your capital separate from the capital of the government, which is in the Ministry of Finance or in the banks of South Sudan. But what's happening? We are not there. Look at what happened even to our central bank. The most qualified one are removed, and you bring people who are traders, who are businessmen to manage the bank. What is happening as we speak now? The dollar has shot up and the bank is almost collapsing, and nobody's talking about it because the real professional who were managing the bank, they were removed. And now they are sitting under trees, and the businessmen who have been looting the country are the one put in charge to manage the bank. So these are some of the mistake, and we are not learning mm-hmm. from all those mistakes. So until we learn, this is what I'm saying, and the learning is very simple: do the right thing. put the right person in the right place. If we start doing things differently from the way we are doing it, this is where I can say South Sudan have learned their lessons and we can move forward.
Yes, we have the revitalized peace agreement of 2018, which is now being slowly implemented, though the president alluded to the fact that it's far below the expectation of many South Sudanese. This revitalized peace agreement has also resulted into the formation of Artigonu, though it's not yet complete, and the forces are right now in the training sites, 18 training sites across the country, ready to be graduated and deployed. And meanwhile, there are so many things that is still to be met during this peace process. Dr. Santino, what is critical to this revitalized peace agreement that can lead to the realization of a permanent peace in the country, given what has happened? We have millions, according to UNOCHA and other UN agencies, over millions of South Sudanese have fled the country. Hundreds of thousands are being sheltered around the countries in POCs and IDP camps. So, what is your take on this, Dr. Santino?
First of all, thank you, Sunny Martin. First of all, the revitalized peace agreement, if you look at it, except with the exception of Chapter 4, much of the peace agreement was simply power sharing between warring parties. It wasn't a peace agreement that was intended to support, to help the people of South Sudan.
So this is not a people's driven process?
It rarely is. It's very much power sharing. That's why we have five vice presidents, mm-hmm. and that's why we have an inflated cabinet. And that is why we have so many generals in the army. Everyone who actually gave themselves whatever kind of ranks they have been allowed to come back into the system. So it was a power, it's basically a power sharing agreement. I think if there is anything we have learned so far is that some players are not going to understand each other in a way that would allow South Sudanese to move forward. We have seen how at this moment even pre-transitional issues have not yet been resolved. And we are almost, many months into the swearing in of the cabinet, and so we still have some state governments that have not been formed, simply because the parties could not agree with each other because of mistrust, because the people cannot work together, and so the peace agreement has good intentions, or especially the Chapter 4, if those reforms are put in place, probably South Sudan can move forward. But I'm afraid, given how slow it has been moving, given how difficult it is for the partners to work together, is revitalized peace agreement really the peace agreement that South Sudanese should have signed? Or could we have moderate,
it's like you are having some kind of doubt in some of these reforms.
The reforms in Chapter 4, as I've said, could be very helpful to this country, but there are elements of the peace agreement that were not well thought out, and so
the
question of power sharing, like at every state you have to have, the government has 55%, the opposition would have 45%, and if you go to some states, they don't have the opposition, and in some states the government is not very well popular there. It's not very popular there, and so sharing this power, when it was conceived, that peace agreement, they did not have an idea who how this peace agreement would be implemented. There is element of hostility at certain levels, and if you go that 45% is percent would be shared by the opposition, people in the government would react quite negatively, and the reverse is also true. And so there are elements of the peace agreement that are not appropriate, and that would make it very difficult for the peace agreement to reach its intended aim.
Okay.
Are we going to have an election by the end of it, or something else going to happen along the way? That is my fear.
Okay. Let's listen to Lona. Lona, being a member of NCSC and a political and civil rights activist, what do you think that is really critical for permanent peace in South Sudan? You have listened to Dr. Santino that a number of benchmarks has not been met, and for sure that gives fear that what is remaining now is critical to spoiling the little that we have now on the table. So what is critical here?
Thank you very much. I think what is critical at this moment is I only wish that South Sudanese, both the political elite and those who join to fight on their behalf, realize that our problems are more than what can be solved by barrel of the gun. If we want to solve our problem by barrel of the gun, we'll always keep fighting over and over like we have done. They fought, they signed the first RCS, but because they thought gun was the solution, they fought again. And right now, if out there they are thinking that gun is the solution, they are going to fight again. So what should be done? I think what needs to be done at this moment is to focus on the reforms, because our problem is systemic. We never established systems. We distributed institutions just because we knew that a country should have institutions. But as Santino and Okuk have said, I would refer to what they have elaborately explained as lack of standards. You know, we have not set standards in this country. If we had set standards in this country, then we would know who would go where to do what. And I will say this, I'm sorry, I'm saying it on radio where everybody's hearing, but it's my responsibility as a citizen of this country. Most of our institutions do not have clear guidelines. So where will that institution go? And yes, the reforms, I would agree that yes, some of the things outlined in the agreement are very good. But the agreement is not perfect, but the question is there will to implement that? And from where I sit, I would definitely say that to some extent, some of the things that our leaders signed to, they did not intend to implement, but they did not also have clear plan of how to avoid implementing it. And that is where we are going to have a stalemate. Number one, look at the appointment of the vice presidents. I expected that the parties would have already known who they are going to appoint. It took them forever until the time when the appointments are happening. Some parties like SOA are still struggling to see who should be appointed. That is so bad for citizens because it shows lack of leadership within that particular group. Number two is the parties all signed to specific provisions. For example, they all signed that they will send the list of their nominees for the reconstitution of parliament to NCSC before it's announced. It has proven to be so difficult for them to do that. So the question is, did they even know what they were doing? Did they pay attention to what they had included in the agreement? Were they willing to do it, or they just signed to get out of Addis?
But what does it signal really?
It signals irresponsibility. It signals irresponsibility in the sense that when that was presented, if they knew they were not going to adhere to it, they shouldn't have signed it. They should have given another proposal. But signing what you knew you were not going to implement, to me as a citizen, is irresponsible.
Okay.
Number two is that the reforms that are enshrined in the agreement, some of them are really necessary. They need to have happened way before today. If they really intend that South Sudan needs to move from this turmoil to the next level, then they should have prioritized some of those reform agenda. But until today, you realize that even the reform agenda, they talk about reform, is dying.
Okay.
And I think that is problematic.
Okay, let's find out more from Dr. Benjamin Machar. The hopes and aspirations of the people of South Sudan ended If you speak to many South Sudanese, they will testify to you. It ended on the 15th of December 2013. And up to now, there are people who are still in the bush, like around Yeh River County. We still have here and there schemes, like my colleague said it earlier on, Yach. So the question now is, this conflict that started on the 15th of December 2013 up to 2018 have disrupted a lot of economic activities, the livelihood of the citizens, and also had been paralyzed. What measures do you think, as a political science, can you prescribe to address this and to kickstart nation building process once again, after many people have been displaced, many people are still trying to establish where their loved ones are?
Thank you again. Our big problem in South Sudan, we are not learning from the example of other countries. How is state appointed, constructed, and you would be able to puzzle in matters such as nation building, economic development, education, equality, observation of civil liberties, individual rights, and what have you. We started with wrong footage, and that wrong footage was actually involving too many people in the national's discord, those who do not deserve to be part and parcel of any processes at all whatsoever. And this is what I mean. Our peace process, the way that we have been looking to stabilize the country, have always resulted into some sort of stalemate. And in any civil war, and to be able to forge a nation building that is cohesive and integral to the developments of the country, you need one warring party to win militarily. To win militarily. There is only one evidence that I know whereby it was a negotiated peace settlement that had brought about stability in the world, and that was the case of El Salvador. And it happened in a way that the warring parties had actually fought each other viciously, whereby the rebellions, which was actually an indigenous rebellion, had militarily attacked and did more damage to the government side, the main elite version of the country. On the other hand,
but Dr. Ben, this
I'm giving you the context, because okay. There is no way we can analyze it without giving the context.
Right.
We are actually footing the issue of human rights.
But this particular model of zero game thing cannot fit in a nation that in a country like South Sudan that we call some of these are brothers.
No.
In
a war, it is atrocious.
This is a fight between brothers.
Even between us and Northern Sudanese, we are even brothers, because most of those peoples who give birth to Northern Sudanese were our women. So should not be the best line to measure thing. We want to correct what had happened. So there has to be one warring party, either rebellion or the government to win. And then after one party has won, it has to initiate the political discord in the country in its own image, the way that it defined the nation. So we have not arrived at this. And all this peace agreement that we are talking about will fail. And there is a need to find a solution to found another Second Republic. And Second Republic will not deliver either after the first. And we might go to the Ugandan model. We had the first republic with Obote, the second republic with Amin, and the third republic in 1980, and the fourth republic in 1986. So we have a long way to go until there's one winning a party. I care less whether it is the current government or to the rebellion.
Okay.
And so long there is only one. We are not going to arrive at reform.
Let's find that. Yeah.
In the country using peace negotiation.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Benjamin. Let's find out more from Dr. Santino. All of you are saying that we should have learned from other countries that has gone through this kind of turmoil. And also we had the great chance of also bringing in on board expertise who knows what's called nation building. And like Dr. Okuk said, we don't lack human resource. We have people in this country who are well versed, only that they are not being put in the right place. The question now people will be asking, what should have been done to make sure we take the right path? Dr. Santino.
Thank you once again, Martin. Let me go back to 2005, when peace agreement was signed, there were so many South Sudanese militias on the side of the government. And prior to his passing, Dr. Garang initiated what was called the Big Tent then, Big Tent policy. That is the policy that accepted back those of Dr. Riek Machar, those of Dr. Lema Kol, and other groups. The intention was to unify the forces of South Sudanese so that we have one front. That policy was carried along by our president Salva Kiir, and that's why we had those of Matip Nial and many other militias
coming back,
and they were accepted with their ranks. Some of them were
with all their militias.
Yeah. Some of them were actually civilians who put on military uniform, and they were accepted. Over time, when he kept on absorbing these militias, the militias outnumbered the military, the actual SPLA element. And so, and you know, when you are not trained, when you have no moral basis for what it means to be a soldier defending your country, when you are a civilian given the arms, you are likely to resort to violence than restraint, self-restraint. And so when we saw everything exploded in 2013, it was part of lack of military discipline that led to that violence. And, you know, politicians took advantage of this unruly behavior within the military and our police and national security forces. People were behaving in a reckless way. And so politicians who were dissatisfied or who were not getting their right share took advantage of this unruly behavior and mobilized their forces around how to protect their interest. And so what we actually saw in 2013 had been building up to that very moment. And part of the reason was lack of equitable sharing of resources. We saw very few people pocketing.
So that's the question we are asking, really, with the observation of this militia group from Sudan, with the hope that we were heading towards a referendum, which indeed happened. Mm-hmm. What should have been put in place to make sure we have a rule of law, and also putting in mind that as long as we have this idea of separation of voting for referendum in 2011, we should also put in some mechanism. Once this succeed, whenever we cross the bridge, there
right.
must be rule of
Absolutely.
Law and accountability.
Absolutely, you're right. Sorry, excuse me. But the issue was very risky at the beginning. I think the government was trying to strike a balance between satisfying this militia's interests and making sure that we transition to the next level, which is the referendum, which we finally achieved. But from the moment independence was achieved, there should have been an overhaul in the military.
Dr. Santino, let us be materialistic here. This is the situation we find ourselves in. From your analysis, yes, the Big Ten's policy set precedence of rebellion in the country. And we have seen the consequences of all these things. This is the situation that we are in now. What are we to do? What is your prescription as a legal scholar?
The policy of appeasement has to be stopped. At this moment, the rule of law should be the supreme law. The idea that certain people can get away with whatever reckless behavior they have conducted for so long and still get away with it over time has to be stopped. Because if you don't do that, it incentivizes others to behave in a similar way.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Dr. Okuk, we have seen recently governors were appointed, and two governors from Jonglei and Upper Niles were not appointed. And we are talking today about the 9th anniversary of South Sudan independence and the status of nation building. We have seen citizens from across the country are polarized on ethnic lines or on economic classes and what have you. So what do you think could be a way to address this and bring a unity? Of course, nation building can't happen overnight, and it cannot happen when citizens are divided. What do you think is a way forward here?
The way forward is to respect the letter and the spirit of the revitalized agreement as it was signed by those parties. And I mean the five parties that signed the agreement, not everybody running in between, including the community leaders, the whatever, is the parties.
Yes.
So it is their sole responsibility to make sure that they implement that agreement as they have declared it to the public and to the international community. That text of the agreement is very clear. It starts with power sharing, as Santino put it, but it does not end with the power sharing. The power sharing is to put the government in place, what they call the revitalized government of national unity. And it has to be a government of national unity, not a government where governors are sworn in a SPLM house for one party. No, it's a government of national unity for South Sudan, where the diversity is respected, where no one party try to run away with power in the country. So this is the government of national unity.
Just hold on,
yeah,
hold on, Dr. Bay.
This is what the agreement is saying. Now
you are reading the agreement wrong.
No, I read that agreement very correctly.
Go ahead, Dr.
I wrote a book about it. I analyze that agreement every day, and I know what it is. So you better debate me on something else.
Go ahead, Dr. Okuk.
So now
substantials.
Now the parties are not willing to implement that agreement in letter and spirit, particularly the principal parties to that agreement. That is the incumbent Tigono, led by President Salva Kiir, and you have the SPLM-IO led by Dr. Riek Machar. They are the main principal. They are playing Tom and Jerry on the agreement. And that's why we have delayed the implementation of the security arrangements, which were prerequisite even for the formation of the government. This security arrangement is nil up to now. Nothing really much apart from gathering some forces in the cantonment and training center, and nothing moves after that. The agreement did not say they stay in those places forever. They are supposed to do what they are supposed to do and graduate it, then they become the unified necessary forces in the country. That has not happened.
Okay.
When it came to the power sharing,
yes,
it took them a long time who should even take which ministry and whatever. Again, when it came to the state, it took them a long time who should take which state. And even when it has been finalized, who should take which state, who should be appointed is also getting another problem. The agreement is very clear. No party has the right to reject the nominee of the other parties. What has happened now? Victoria Gas nominated General Oloing to become the governor of Upper Nile. President Salva Kiir is reluctant to appoint him because some community leaders somewhere are inciting him, some pressure group are somewhere and inciting him not to do that. And I don't know. If I were President Kiir, I would respect the agreement rather than the pressure groups that are coming to
me. Okay, I can see Dr. Ben. I can see Dr. Ben as a burning point.
The last one is the Jungle State.
Yes.
The Jungle State is the problem of SOA. As Santino has put it, SOA has its own internal problem. They cannot agree as one coalition. They got disintegrated. And who disintegrated them? It's themselves and the government. Incumbent Tigono has contributed to disintegrate the SOA. And that disintegration has led them not to come up with one nominee for the Jungle State. Mm-hmm. They are presenting two candidates up to now. And the president is is torn between which candidate to take, because if you take this one, the other one will complain. If you take this one, the other one will complain.
Okay, so listen to Dr. Ben before we come to Lona.
Yeah. I think the problem was the two-state is going back to 1991, because there are some individuals, politicians with their tribal base that have always played the issue of Cain and Abel. Take, for example, slum is the problem of this matter in both states. My other brother can just sound very nice, but in fact, the problem down there, it is the Chuluk aligning with React, and Olonyo was not.
Please, this is tribalizing the issue. It's not correct. It's not all the Chuluk. Please don't be tribalist. It's not. We are not discussing tribalism here. If there are some individuals, don't say Chuluk. It's not allowed. It's not good. This is hate speech.
What's wrong with you? Are you trying to control free speech?
No, don't make
it.
Don't involve communities. Say individual who are involved.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. First of all, it's not good to be mentioning tribes here. We have to focus on that. Okay, let's first go to... yes, Lona. Okay, Lona. Thank you so much. Let's find out more from Dr. Santino and Lona. We have these questions coming in here from Jet. And he says, since we got our independence, our hopes have faded away. And the question right now is that we see people buying good V8s and living luxuriously. How long shall the people of South Sudan wait to have a sustainable peace in this country? Let's begin with Lona.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. I think this is a very interesting debate.
Yeah.
Before we get to how long shall the people of South Sudan wait before they get peace, or I should tackle this together with the question of what is the prescription?
Yeah.
And to me, the prescription has to be precise. And possibly that is what will give peace to people of South Sudan. One, the political leadership in this country need to acknowledge that the gaps and our failure as a nation is lack of or is failure to develop systems, institutions, and standards. That there is it's non-negotiable.
Yeah.
That need to be recognized. Number two is we need to recognize that what citizens expect from a state is provision of services. We need to, as a nation, South Sudan needs to start investing her resources, which Dr. Cook earlier called as the opportunities of South Sudan, that need to be invested in services and development.
Yeah.
And we need to have the concept of common good as the centerpiece for
what we need. But all these are provided in this revitalized peace agreement.
Yes. Number three is that we need to have a clear vision of where we are heading with this country. In my own opinion, it's like what is happening is a politics of trial and error without clear vision. Even the political parties, if you ask them, where do they want to go? Where do they want to take the country? Apart from getting themselves into positions, it's quite not clear to us as citizens what is the objective of those parties.
But when you talk to some of them, they said we have the political will. The opposition will say we have the political will. That's why we are here in Juba without our forces. And the president also promised that he is committed to implement the agreement.
Yes, that is not enough. As citizens, when a party says they have the political will, then the next thing we want to ask, which is not in the political discourse in South Sudan, is what is the manifesto of these particular parties? You know, that is not there. A manifesto should not only be developed when there is an election. A manifesto should be there to articulate the ideologies that propagate a particular party. We are not seeing that. So to me, as a South Sudanese, I think the parties need to go through a process of maturity to be able to deliver for the country. So what is it that will bring peace to the people of South Sudan? As my brother out there is asking, we need services, we need development, we need investment in common good for the people of South Sudan. That is what will bring peace in South Sudan.
Yes, you are listening to the Round Table with me, Sunny Martin.
And me, Yaj Grant.
And today we are discussing the 9th independence anniversary of South Sudan and also the status of nation building. And in the studio we have Dr. Santino Ayuel Longar, who is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Juba.
And we have Dr. Ben Machar, a former lecturer at Townsend University, USA, and is an independent political analyst in the country.
And we also have Lona Merikaje, a member of the civil society organization and also the National Constitution Amendment Committee.
We have Dr. James O'Cook, the political analyst at the Center for Strategic and Policy Studies.
And later on, our lines will be open to you where you can call us and join our discussion on 0912062079 or 0912062950, or you can visit our Facebook page and drop your question like what others have done right here. And our guest here will be answering all your questions right here. 9 years down the line, what do you think should have been done to put our country on the path of peace, development and prosperity? And that's what we are discussing right here on Roundtable, coming to you live from Juba. And we have to go for a quick break. We shall be back.